This is On the Other Hand. Podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders and local experts.
Hello, and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. Get ready for today's conversation with a community leader and subject matter expert in Arkansas who is helping work towards solutions.
On occasion, we feature conversations with subject matter experts, which is what we're going to do today. And these subject matter experts often offer helpful information that helps us better understand our group divisions and how to improve polarization and similar problems. And today, we're going to be speaking with one of these experts who focuses specifically on social media and online information behavior. So, Glenn, tell us who we'll be talking with today.
Thanks, April. Listen, I'm really excited and honored to have with us today Dr. Nitin Agarwal, the Jerry L. Malden Intergy Chair and Distinguished Professor at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock in their Information Science Department. He is also the director of the, get this, Collaboratorium for Social Media and Online Behavioral Studies, which has the cool acronym of COSMOS. His work, as I understand it, and he's going to help us understand better this, it focuses on influence operations online, information environment manipulation, misinformation, disinformation, propaganda campaigns, and I understand he primarily does this for those campaigns that originate outside the U.S. but could potentially impact U.S. and our defense strategic interests. So we look forward to hearing from him today and helping us better understand the work that he does. I think it's clear from what you've heard so far, he is researching a highly critical area for the security of our country and for its impact on the health of our society and the political environment. So we're really happy to have him. Well, welcome to On the Other Hand, Nitin.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Glenn and April.
You bet. Let's start by having you tell us a bit about yourself. Tell us how you got to the University of Arkansas, Little Rock, and what kind of led you into your current area of research in online influence?
Absolutely. So it's kind of a winding path. I'm originally from India, from New Delhi, and I came to the United States to do my education in computer science. So I landed in Arizona State University to study for my doctorate in computer science, data mining, databases, etc. And I naturally gravitated towards behaviors in online world, in the internet forums, etc. And this is back in 2003 and 4 when none of the YouTube, Twitter, Facebooks were there. I believe Facebook was still in dorm and Harvard. So it had yet to get out, but we had a lot of interesting behaviors from blogs, MySpace, LiveJournal. These were some of the old social media platforms, which are still existent, but not as heavily used as we see in Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, etc. So anyway, I was quite interested in studying online behaviors. So I started looking into a new discipline called social computing, which at that time didn't exist. So my research kind of pioneered that area of social computing. And I started looking at how individuals behave, how groups behave, what are the group dynamics on the online or the cyber world. And it started out as mostly studying the positive behaviors that we had seen, like the socio-political transformation during the Arab Spring. And at that time, social media was considered to be one of the great forces of change, positive change, a vehicle for positive change that led to socio-political transformation, democratization of content production and participation. But now we have also seen how this has been abused by adversarial or malicious actors into ugly forms of behaviors. So my research focuses mainly on the good, bad, and ugly behaviors. That's how I characterize on social media platforms. And it has been evolving ever since. So after completing my doctoral degree at Arizona State University, I was looking for jobs, and I also applied for University of Arkansas Little Rock in the Information Science Department for a faculty position. And when I came here, I met several interesting colleagues, and also the then dean of the College of Engineering, who was Dean Mary Good. And she had a vision. She wanted me to expand this research area into something called web science. And that intrigued me quite a bit because it gave me the flexibility to apply the research that I had embarked on and continue expanding it into a research program. So I was really thrilled to hear her vision and how that aligned very well with what I was doing in my research. So I joined UALR and I've been here since. So it has been 14 years and I'm loving it every day here. I started out with one student and now I have close to 40 students in my research program who are doing their master's, PhD, and some have even graduated and stayed for their postdoctoral fellowships. Several students who have graduated from our program have gone on to work in several leading industries like Google, Microsoft, Amazon, LinkedIn, Snapchat, and many others, Axiom, Walmart, as data scientists or data senior data scientists in leadership roles. Many of them have gravitated towards academia and started their own labs. So I'm really looking forward to expanding the Cosmos Research Center in the coming years to delve into all these interesting research problems.
And you did all of that starting with one graduate student.
That is correct. And also the help with my colleagues, the help from the university leadership, and many other folks who probably we won't have time to name. But as we say, it takes a village to raise a kid. I think it takes a whole nation to raise a research lab. So I'm really thrilled and kind of privileged and blessed to have all that support.
Okay, excellent. Well, it sounds like you've done a tremendous job of growing that area that you're responsible for, so I'm sure people are very happy with that. And I know that you do a lot of different research. You have students who pursue their own lines. Can you maybe give us a little bit of an idea of some of the key lines of research that you're currently working on or that are coming out of your lab that you want to let us know about?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, that our research mainly focuses on the good, bad, and the ugly behaviors that we see on social media platforms. That's sort of a top view of our research. What we have been focusing on is how malicious behaviors manifest on social media platforms. How do we identify those malicious behaviors? How do we study the impact of those behaviors? How they spread on social media platforms? How they affect our society, but also we want to study, and we are actually looking at quite in depth, is the collective behaviors, how individuals organize, coordinate, or mobilize support for various campaigns, whether it is a campaign for some social good or campaign for malicious endeavors. We have looked at things like Arab Spring. We have studied the role of social media platforms in women's right to drive movement in Saudi Arabia and other gender inequitable rights and practices in Saudi Arabia. We have also looked at how social media platforms help extremists, terrorists like ISIS groups, in their recruitment, in their radicalization, and also using social media platforms for raising funds and support for their activities. More recently, we have been looking at how social media platforms are utilized by state or non-state actors to coordinate misinformation or disinformation campaigns, propaganda campaigns, influence operations, that can influence our beliefs and behaviors in various parts of the world. So we have looked at, we have also very intimately worked with NATO their public affairs officers, information operations officers, to study what type of narratives are being spread in social media platforms when NATO conducts exercises in the European region. We have also looked at the same in the Indo-Pacific region, how various state and non-state actors amplify anti-West, anti-US narratives in that region to further their own agendas, their own interests. But most importantly, we focus on all these problems from a perspective of social computing, meaning how can we study all these behaviors at large scale? Because when we look at social media platforms, we are not looking at 10 or 20 data points. We are looking at millions of data points. So our computing or information science approaches have to be scalable enough to ingest all of that data, weed out all the noise, and extract the signal that can help the operational community, the policymakers, to make decisions, to make appropriate policies, to absorb our research. And we have several examples of that.
So are you able to tell us a little bit about who your customers are? I know you do something with the government and the defense. To what extent can you share with us a little bit of who all is involved in that to consume your data?
Absolutely. So much of our research is geared towards looking at U.S. national defense and strategic interests. So these are efforts that are supported and funded in part by U.S. Army Research Office, U.S. Office of Naval Research, U.S. Air Force Research Lab, DARPA, and also NSF, which is the U.S. National Science Foundation. And collectively, these are close to $25 million in funding, which is spread across 20 active grants and 15 expired grants, which had led to several research products like tools that are constantly used by public affairs officers, info ops and PSYOP officers at NATO and also at Indo-Pacific region. So we have worked with the U.S. Department of State in the Indo-Pacific region. We have several working partners and NGOs and nonprofit organizations as subject matter experts in Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Taiwan, Singapore, Australia. We have also worked with Australian DSTO, which is the counterpart of U.S. DARPA in Australia, and many other clients. Domestically, we have worked with Arkansas Attorney General's Office during our COVID crisis, and we helped Arkansas Attorney General's Office in combating or raising awareness about misinformation about COVID and scams that were originating or affecting Arkansans. So yeah, we have several of these efforts, and I would be happy to elaborate on any of these efforts.
We might have to have multiple sessions if we have you elaborate on all of these. What wonderful work, and it's so exciting to have you here in Little Rock actually working with students and bringing in lots of grant money, but also I'm sure you're bringing in students from all over the world that are working with you. So most of your things that you mentioned is focusing on information influence that originates outside of the United States. And I'm wondering if you could give us some kind of high level lessons that you have brought away from this work that might have implications for our country's online and information environment.
Absolutely. And I believe that there are several parallels that can be drawn and lessons that can be learned from our studies. In fact, some of the work that we had done with Arkansas Attorney General's office leveraged our existing work that looked at influence campaigns outside the U.S., particularly in the European region or the currently Indo-Pacific region. So we have been looking at all those efforts and how to apply those in the U.S. Environment. What we have found is in influence campaigns, there are several ways that influence campaigns are conducted. Now, we call them as tactics, techniques, and procedures or in short, TTPs, that are leveraged by adversarial or malicious actors to conduct such influence campaigns. And in many cases, we have seen that these tactics or these TTPs are quite common in nature. I'll give you an example. We have seen use of multiple social media platforms to conduct influence campaigns. So during COVID-19, when we saw a barrage of misinformation hurled towards more vulnerable populations, we saw use of Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, WhatsApp, and many other social media platforms together to spread such messages. And these would come towards your network and then propagated by your network of contacts that would influence your beliefs and behavior. So when we study this in information science manner, then we start constructing these networks of influence, and that shows us which campaign has larger or smaller influence. So these are some of the examples where research can show what campaign is becoming more successful, which campaigns are not gaining momentum, so as to help the policymakers or decision makers prioritize their efforts to counter or diffuse one campaign or the other. So these are some of the examples, and I can go over on some of the other TTPs if you would like me to elaborate upon.
Yeah, I would love to hear more, but I want to ask a question that's a definitional question. First of all, you've mentioned disinformation and misinformation a couple of times, and I would love to have you define how do you operationalize that or figure out that something is what you would consider to be dis or misinformation.
Wonderful question. And I often get that when I speak at conferences or other scientific meetings. There is almost always there is a confusion between these two terms, mis and disinformation. There is a distinct difference between these two concepts. Misinformation is false information that may not have an intent. So something that has been false information that has been spread unwittingly or non-deliberately, versus disinformation where you have an intent, you have certain agendas that you want to further. So this is the key difference between these two terms. Now the way we operationalize this is we try and use something called social cyber forensics to attribute the intent. So whether this information has been or this false information has been propagated by certain known actors, has this information been espoused by representatives of certain groups or certain state actors, and that would allow us to establish that intent, versus in the cases where we do not know the intent, then we would just simply call it as misinformation. Now, there is another term which is called malinformation, which is quite different from these two, which basically says that information that is posted by a group or an individual to affect someone or to hurt someone. These could be also considered as things like doxing, where journalists' information, contact information could be posted on a website, and then they would start getting calls or threat emails, etc.
And you call that mal information?
Malinformation. So information that is posted with malicious intent.
So with the intent of actually harming an individual or group of individuals. So you said that you had other examples of tactics, techniques, and procedures that are being used. Give us another example.
Absolutely. So I'm going to give you some examples which are quite new, because as we have seen this research space evolving over time, so has these tactics, right? We have been working in this space since 2005, when we did not have any Twitter, Facebook, or YouTube. They were largely blogs. But we saw such type of mis or disinformation being posted on blogs during US presence in Iraq and in Afghanistan, right? So we started seeing those type of misinformation or anti-US narratives on these blogs, how US forces are disrespecting the local communities or the local community leaders, while all of that was untrue. So we started working from that point onwards. And now what we have seen that this space has evolved quite a bit. I'll give you a very specific example, which is the role of artificial intelligence, AI. We call this as adversarial AI, which is used by malicious actors to post information. So we have all seen those videos, which we call deep fakes, which are artificially created, right? These could be videos of a leader of a country giving a speech or talking something which they may not have, right? They may not have done it. So, but there are all these AI techniques that can be used to create such videos. These are called deepfakes. Now, there are also something called shallow fakes, which is not as sophisticatedly done, where you may not have that country leader or a very influential person saying things may not be true, but these are just images and scripts that are being read by automated agents, like we have on our phone, like Siri or Alexa and these and that, right? So these are called artificially produced content. Now, a step further, we see a role of artificial intelligence in spreading these messages. So, for example, on Twitter, on YouTube, we have seen the presence of things called as bots, B-O-T-S, bots, which are computer programs that can quickly amplify the message on your behalf. So, as a malicious actor, someone can write thousands of such accounts or can program thousands of such accounts to amplify the content that they would like to be posted, right? So given a video, you have thousands of Twitter accounts that will just quickly post those on the Twitter streams, right? And the more such content gets out in the social media platforms and the more people start viewing it, then the algorithms pick up that behavior. They think, the algorithms think, that this is a viral content and they would start showing that more. So initially it is all boosted inorganically, but then as algorithms start picking that behavior, it starts getting boosted organically. So this hybrid form of influence tactic or information operation tactic kind of uses this feeding frenzy mechanism of our recommendation algorithm, right? So this is a very sophisticated type of tactics that we have observed in more recent influence campaigns in the Indo-Pacific region. And there are several ways to study this and identify how this is going and how to approach this problem and how to address this issue. And I would be happy to elaborate more on this.
I think we're going to get into some of those, because my guess is all of us have seen, we don't know that we're seeing it, but on our social media feed, we get things that we think are somebody, our friend has created or somebody sent us, but it really was never created by them. It was created artificially and might be mis or disinformation, but we don't know that when we're consuming it and then sending it forward.
It's kind of interesting too, the way you talk about the use of bots. They emulate real people's opinions so that it kind of dupes the algorithms into saying, oh, we need to spread this because it's popular. That's an interesting way of looking at that. So let me ask you this, Nitin. We know that scientists have done a lot of research into polarization, and they understand more and more that this kind of highly polarized environment politically in any country, particularly when it includes mis and disinformation, that tends to have a really negative impact on democratic institutions and traditions. And that's been seen in other countries. It's really kind of going downhill in terms of democratic countries. And it's being seen more and more now that it's happening in this country. So I understand that you focus on outside the U.S. Can you maybe help us understand some of the specific negative impacts that those kinds of influences that you've seen outside the U.S. are happening in the online environment, how they actually impact the health of a democratic government and tradition?
Absolutely. And this is actually a very good question and also a growing concern in our society, because I see how misinformation, disinformation, false narratives lead to polarization of communities, to an extent that it kind of unravels the moral fabric of our society. And I would like to elaborate on that, because we have seen, let's say if we take example of the Indo-Pacific or Southeast Asia region, very quickly a false narrative could be amplified using some of the tactics that I mentioned, and it could lead a mob of violent people, cause certain harmful actions towards an individual or towards an organization, towards an entity. And there are numerous examples where marginalized communities have been, at the focus of that violence. We have seen several cases in Southeast Asia. If you take examples of Rohingya Muslim communities and how conspiracy theories or misinformation around those marginalized communities led to several lynchings, etc. We have also seen some of the cases here in the U.S., particularly during the U.S. Capitol riot, and also more recently in Brazil's election. They had their own capital riots, very much similar to what we had in US. So there are numerous examples of how such polarizations occur. I think what so, as scientists we need to do is to invest more research into such behaviors to understand as quickly as possible whether an activity, a collective action can lead to some type of a violent behavior. We have several projects going on at Cosmos Research Center that look at that collective action phenomena grounded in several social science theories, information manipulation theory, collective action theories, theories of motivated reasoning, theory of social movements, theories of social movement spillover, etc., etc. So there are several social science theories that we leverage in this effort to understand how mobs form, how they coordinate, how they mobilize support, and how they conduct such campaigns, pick up signals or indicators from the data that is available on social media platforms to understand if we can predict in a timely manner that such acts can be prevented, right? So our efforts with Attorney General's Arkansas Attorney General's office also looked at some of those misinformation campaigns that were run during COVID, and we actually created a website which I would encourage your listeners to check out, which is a collection of a lot of misinformation campaigns during COVID-19 and how they were debunked. We have used social cyber forensics to understand and attribute those misinformation or scams to the actors who were spreading such rumors and such efforts. And the website can be found from our group's website, our center's website, which is cosmos.ualr.edu. And there is a section called Tools. And if you go to the Tools section, you will find all the tools and products that we have produced so far that look at various social media platforms, understand the discourse in various social media platforms like blogs, videos, etc. And also this tool that I mentioned about, which is the COVID-19 misinformation tracker. And such efforts, I believe, are important because I believe that research is one part of the equation for this solution. The other parts of the equation are education, awareness, which is very fundamental. We need to make sure that more and more people know about such efforts going on. More and more people critically analyze the information that is presented on these social media platforms. And the third part of the equation is kind of a synergy between government and these social media companies, where they have to come together to find middle ground so that way we can start to approach this space in a more democratized, in a more civil manner. Social media platforms give voice to everyone, but that has also created inequality. Some people have, larger voices or higher voices versus the others. So that equality has to be there. There should be more transparency from social media platforms. We just spoke about algorithms, about biases in these algorithms, about bots and so on. So if there is more transparency, then we can also see what's going on behind the curtain in these social media platforms, in these algorithms, and how researchers can contribute to such efforts. So that's what I believe should be the model to go forward.
Okay, that's very good. So I think we'll get a little more into some related solutions here shortly. I was curious, you said that I can see how the Attorney General would very much appreciate your input in helping, because one of the things they get a lot is, people who are misusing them and misleading them, and more of that's taking place online now. So I see that as a great service you're providing to the state of Arkansas. The COVID work that you've talked about was done during the previous administration. Have you had a chance to develop much of a direction yet with the new administration's Attorney General office?
That's a great question again. So I should also mention that we are working very closely with Arkansas Research Alliance, which is a group that promotes research, champions researchers' efforts in the state of Arkansas. So we are working with them to establish such scientific collaborations with the current administration, both in the Attorney General's office as well as the Governor's office, so that the work that is currently being done in Arkansas for largely outside US, largely the entire world, can also be absorbed within the state to help Arkansans.
Well, thanks for joining us on today's edition of On the Other Hand. This was the first part of our conversation with Dr. Nitin Agarwal from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Be sure to check out the second part of this conversation with Nitin, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. You can find us on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org. Again, that's arkansas.braverangels.org, or on many popular podcast sites.
When you visit our website, you can help us improve our program by responding to a brief survey. Use the link on our podcast webpage and let us know. You can also email us for program or speaker ideas or other feedback. Just send that email to otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar, no spaces, @gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.